Hi, I'm Michael Silverblatt. Thanks for tuning in to Bookworm. Some of our most exciting storytellers share their work orally, and that's the kind of work you can hear on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate stories, cleverly made documentaries produced all around the world by some of the most talented radio producers we have. Check out Unfictional. You can find it on KCRW's iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gudolf Hindenburg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, my guest is Luis Alberto Urrea. He is not just a guest, but kind of a friend. I'm crazy about his work. He writes everything. He writes poetry, essays, stories, nonfiction books, long novels, short novels, comic novels. Whatever there is to be written, he wants to get his hand in. And it's kind of marvelous because he's been proclaimed by the National Endowment of the Arts to be one of the 30, I believe, living and dead, big reads of America. So he's been traveling to schools and libraries all over to read his work. His work is being discovered. How many years are you going to be spending doing this?
Well, you know, as I always tell people, most of the readers for the big read are dead. So as long as I'm still breathing, I guess it's good for schools to have somebody they can actually look at. But it's going to be a while.
Now we have two books by Luis Alberto Urrea, a book of short stories called The Water Museum, published by Little Brown, a book of poetry called The Tijuana Book of the Dead, published by Soft Skull, coming out virtually simultaneously. And what I noticed as I was reading was that in some of the stories, if you took the train a couple of stations past where it stops, you arrive not in Short Storyville, but in poetry. And I wanted to begin by having you hear a story from the Water Museum where we travel through a battle scene. It's quite serious. It turns unaccountably comic and then surreal and then amazing until it arrives at crazy. It arrives at image and poetry. This is a memory story. It's called Chametla. And what is Chametla before we start?
Chametla is a province in the state of Sinaloa in Mexico. And it's just such a wonderful word. It's so resonant. And I heard it my whole life as a kid. So I had heard once that there had been a revolutionary battle of Chametla, and that just stuck with me. The Battle of Chametla just sounded so cool that it became this little story.
Let's hear it.
Okay. The last shot fired in the Battle of Chametla hit Private Arnulfo Guerrero in the back of the head. It took out the lower right quadrant, knocking free a hunk of bone roughly the size and shape of a broken teacup. This shot was fired by a federal trooper, who then shouldered his weapon and walked to a cantina on the outskirts of town, where he ate a fine pork stew with 7 corn tortillas and a cup of pulque. The shot was witnessed by Guerrero's best friend, Corporal Angel Garcia, and by Guerrero's dog, Casan. Casan was a floppy-eared Alsatian he'd stolen from a Federales base the year before. Por Dios, Arnulfo, Garcia muttered as he stuffed straw and a long strip of his tunic into the gaping head wound. What have they done to you? Guerrero writhed on the ground, his teeth clenched in a silent rage, froth collecting on his lips. Garcia staunched the bleeding, and wrapped a dirty field dressing around and around his friend's head. Ghassan stood to the side, whining and fretting. Troops were everywhere. And though the Battle of Chametla was over, Garcia didn't know it. So he pulled his comrade onto his shoulders in a straining carry, for Guerrero was at least a foot taller and many pounds heavier. And he struggled to a copse of cottonwoods beside a muddy creek. He put his friend down gently on a bed of leaves and cottonwood fluff, and he tied Ghassan's rope leash to the trunk. Then he snuck down to the creek and filled his hat with water. He tried to wet his friend's lips, but the dying man was already too far gone to drink. They had come out of the mining lands of Rosario, Sinaloa, full of revolution and fun. Men were raised to fight and enjoy fighting. None dared admit they were weary of it, weary of fear, and each had learned to dream. And dreamed at all hours, dreamed while sleeping, while awake and marching, while fighting. Only dreaming carried them through the unending battles. They drunk their fill, slept with country girls in every village, ridden trains to battle. Both Guerrero and Garcia were excited by the trains, their first train rides. Then they were sickened by the rocking of the freight cars and choked by the smoke boiling back over the roof where they fought for space and tried not to be forced off. They coughed black cinders at night. Ghassan was just one of their treasures, one of the fruits of their exploits. They'd stolen guitars, rifles, horses. Guerrero had stolen underwear from haciendas, and Garcia himself had stolen a cigar from the pocket of a sleeping federal captain. They'd seen men hang and watched villages burn. "Don't die now, you bastard," Garcia grunted as he peeked out through the bushes to see if their enemies had fled. "We have so much to do." But Guerrero only moaned and kicked his feet. As night fell, Angel Garcia gathered wood. He peeled back the sullied bandages to let air and moonlight in. The ugly black cavern blown out of Guerrero's head leaked slow and watery blood. His face was pale, his skin was cold, and still he drew breath and occasionally stirred and mumbled. Garcia lit a small fire and moved Guerrero nearer to the flames. He tore long strips from his friend's shirt and rewrapped his head. Why waste a swallow of tequila on him? There was a bottle in his bedroll. He lifted it in a silent toast and drank. He must have drifted off to sleep, for it was Kassan's whimpering that awoke him. The big dog had worked himself free from the rope, and he stood over the prone body of Guerrero and whined. "What is it, boy?" Garcia whispered. Ghassan tilted his head and stared down at Guerrero. The dog yelped. Then he backed away. Garcia crawled over to Guerrero and said, "Arnulfo, are you awake?" The wounded man didn't stir. "What the hell is wrong with you?" Garcia chided the dog. "Nothing here." Then he heard it too, the faint whistling. He inclined his head. There was a plaintive hooting coming from under Guerrero's bandage. Were poor Guerrero's sinuses blowing air out of his skull? Christ, what next? Garcia pulled open the wrapping and was startled to see a small puff of smoke rising from out of his friend's head. He crossed himself. "Ah, cabrón," he said. The whistle again, then another puff of smoke. Ghassan barked. Garcia sat beside the dog and stared. Then, was it? It couldn't be. But a light. A small light was coming out of the ragged hole in Guerrero's head. Garcia bent down, but then had to leap back because a small locomotive rushed out of Guerrero's wound. It fell out of the wound, pulling a coal car and several small cattle cars, as if it were falling off a minuscule bridge in some rail disaster. The soft train fell upon the ground and glistened, puffing like a fish. Ghassan pounced on it and took it in his mouth, shaking it once and gulping it down. "Bad dog," said Garcia. But by then, Guerrero's childhood home had squeezed out of his head. It was quite remarkable. The walls were soft and pink, and the furniture was veiny and tender. Ghassan ate the back porch. Garcia, starving after the battle, skewered the couch, the bed, and the oven on a wire and roasted them over the fire. They tasted like pork. Guerrero grunted once, and a pile of school books plopped out. Soon Garcia was appalled to see Guerrero's parents and boyhood friends. Their cries were puny and heartrending when Ghassan ate them. And naked women. Good God! He didn't know Guerrero had mounted so many naked women. He looked carefully. They came out in a parade of breasts and asses, small legs waving. He couldn't bear it. He couldn't bear his own lust and his own hunger, and he couldn't bear Ghassan's insatiable mouth, and he couldn't bear his own loneliness. If he had tried to make love to them, he would have torn them apart. All these small beings mewled and quickly expired. It was the worst night of his life. He found himself praying that Guerrero would die, but he didn't die. And Garcia decided, finally, irrevocably, that he had to leave his friend to his fate. The damage to his own soul would be too great if he sat there any longer, watching children, priests, grandmothers, goats, wagons, and toys ooze out of Guerrero's bloody head and die on the ground. So he put the rope through Kassan's collar, and he tucked Guerrero's pistol in his own belt, and he put Guerrero's boots on his own feet, and he made his friend as comfortable as possible. Birds gathered, first crows, then magpies and robins. Finally, gulls came from the coast. They seemed to be praying to Guerrero, for they bowed to him repeatedly. They stayed there and fed on his dreams until they were too heavy to fly.
Well, isn't that the craziest thing you've ever heard?
It's a little weird.
That was Luis Alberto Urrea reading from his book, The Water Museum, the story Chametla. Okay, now, Luis, tell me, how does such a short story get written? Is it invented as you go along?
Two things, boyhood obsession with Ambrose Bierce and a boyhood obsession with René Magritte. So I was, you know, thinking about this Mexican revolutionary story, and I kept imagining that wonderful painting of the locomotive bursting out of the fireplace of Magritte's. We just saw the show in Chicago. It started life many years ago, perhaps as a poem, interestingly, and then turned into a story that never worked, which originally was called The Bird Feeder. And then, you know, you put it away and it sits there in the mulch, sort of festering away and dropping little roots. And then all of a sudden it just burst on me and came essentially whole. It said, this is what I am. And it started coming out. And, the part that made me really happy is the silliest part of the story. But when the dog eats the train and he says, bad dog. It's so ridiculous that it made me chuckle. And I thought, okay, you know, that's good.
Well, it's a part of the story where the risk is at its height, where as readers saying, are we going to go with this? A train is coming out of a dying soldier's wound and his dog is eating the train. Wait, hold on a second. And it gets worse.
Yeah.
In the, you know, grandmother comes out, the childhood home comes out, and then there's this kind of tenderness. And we kind of realize, without putting into words, that as we die, our pasts assemble themselves in front of us.
I think these are some of the things that haunt me. And It's definitely the oddest story, I'd say, in the book, though one of the things that fascinates me is how easily life slips into surrealism or into a kind of a grace, kind of a, you know, not to be James Joyce with epiphanies and so forth, but there's a whole element to me of this unexpected and undefined grace that happens, and we often don't catch it. We don't see it.
Well, this book is full of many different kinds of short stories. Although they have a kind of unifying theme, some of them take place among high school kids who are on a thieving run, and some of them take place during the big crash when all sorts of houses were repossessed by the banks and thieves could break in and steal huge flat-screen TVs.
And, at will.
you know, that it's like a party when it happens.
Yeah.
And they invite a college friend, a boy who's gone off to college. He's not one of Los Vatos anymore.
Right.
Did I say it right?
Yeah, Vatos. Yeah, man. And they get him because he talks white, loco. So, you know, that's the position I find myself in with some of my family and my old associates. You talk white, man.
So you better come along, and in case any police
trouble.
Stop us while we're stealing from these
talk
houses,
white to them.
You can hold a bunch of paperwork and a clipboard and talk white to the police.
Tell them we work for a bank. We're just repossessing stuff for the bank. They'll listen to you.
And the stories are kind of amazing. They're very different from the two novels for which my guest Luis Urrea is famous, The Hummingbird's Daughter and what was the second? Queen of America. These really are neighborhood stories?
Yeah, a little bit, you know, regional stories. You know, we were saying before we turned on the machines, it's sort of my Whitman sampler. You can taste all the different flavors that I think are interesting right now. It's also, I think, a transitional book for me because it's split fairly evenly, I think, between border-related vato kind of stories and other stories. And I think I find myself, you know, like Dante in that wood, you know, halfway through my life, and I'm seeing other pathways opening. So the forthcoming works may not have anything to do with the border. So,
well, not to reveal any secrets, but your wife refers to it as your gateway book.
The gateway drug. So that, you know, people who are curious, because there are a lot of people who haven't read my stuff. I mean, a lot of people don't want to start with a 700-page historical novel about shamans. So, you know, this gives them a chance to pick something up and see what I do. One of the stories accidentally, by the way, won the Edgar Award for Best Mystery. I don't know how that happened, but you know I was going to put it in the book, you know.
Well, it's an amazing story. It's a story about addictive love.
Yes.
Which becomes a story about other kinds of addictions, including the addiction for power. And the girl's father is powerful and puts the young white boy who shouldn't be marrying his daughter onto a helicopter where they're going off shooting rival drug lords. And you go, what? Where is this story taking me? And in a way, that's the job of fiction, huh?
Well, I want to surprise the reader and myself. And also, you know, he's co-opted. His own desire makes him rush hither and thither into this thing that's way beyond him, and they give him a choice: join or die. Either way, but you're going to join us, and if you do, you know, you're making the classic Faustian deal, right? You're selling yourself to somebody. And for me, the best scene in that story is when he finds himself in trouble with the dad for not showing up to supper, and the father starts sort of threatening him in this bizarre conversation, which is...
He's in a French restaurant.
Yeah.
What is this guy doing, this Mexican drug lord?
He's showing off. You know, he's sophisticated.
He's drinking martinis.
And smoking he's a cigar.
Smoking a cigar in a restaurant that's a non-smoking restaurant, but the waiter and the chef know that there's no choice. Bring him the ashtray.
Do what he wants.
Do what he wants.
I have to tell you, that scene I stole from real life. Somebody that I stood up for dinner, and he invited us over for dinner the second day. And that exact scenario played out with the cigar. And I thought, I'm terrified of this guy. And he looks at me and says, why you do this violence to me? I thought, uh-oh, because I didn't show up. He says, I don't care. I have my drinks. I don't care you show up or not. It's okay with me. And I thought, oh, it's definitely not okay that I didn't show up. And it's haunted me. So I put it in a story.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. I'm talking with Luis Alberto Urrea, author of The Water Museum and also a book of poetry, The Tijuana Book of the Dead. And we'll be back after this brief break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Luis Alberto Urrea about his recent books, Tijuana, Book of the Dead, and The Water Museum, the first a book of poetry and the second a collection of short stories. And as we are discovering, there are bridges between fiction and poetry of every sort, between life and fiction, bridges of every sort,
oh, yeah,
between death and surrealism, bridges of every sort. They say that he is a writer of the borderland. I say he's a writer of the bridge. The border only exists because the bridge has not yet been built.
Ah, huh? Thank you. I think our job is bridges. And you know how sometimes people say something to you that's so absurd that it ends up seeming wise in a Zen kind of way? And somebody said to me at one of these billions of border things I end up doing, you know, if you just knock the wall over sideways, it becomes a bridge. And I thought, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. And then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, oh my God, that's exactly right. If you just turn the wall on its side, it becomes a bridge. And, you know, the question of the border to me is just a brutal metaphor for the separation between us as people. And, you know, all you have to do is spend your life in front of hundreds of strangers like I do to know that the border runs through every audience. You know it. You're on the air. You know, you never know what you're going to say that will set off some rage or disappointment or protest. You know?
Well, most of the time, if you are as heartfelt as I end up wanting to be, the letters that come are letters of appreciation.
Yes, absolutely.
That say, you open my heart. I am a what have you, a community college flake and a part-time janitor, but when I listen to the show, I'm a reader.
Yeah.
And you introduced me to worlds I never felt I belonged in.
Yeah.
And that's what writing is about. That's what reading is about. That's why we do what we do. I mean, that's the important thing. Now tell me, the book of poetry, first of all, what is a book of the dead?
Well, you know, it's the Egyptian book of the dead and the Tibetan books of the dead. They were, you know, they were manuals and handbooks on the journey to the afterlife, and not only how to prepare for the afterlife, but what happens to one when one gets there and so forth. And I had been working on poetry and a particular poetry book for at least 10 years, and I'd put it away and give it up. And when Arizona went into its orgy of anti-Mexicanness and immigration agitation, I started trying to do things in Arizona to combat it. And then, you know, they banned all the books and annihilated Mexican-American studies and started imprisoning children for protesting the lack of their poetry. They took, and not only Latino writers, I was in good company. I got six books banned, so I felt like I was pretty cool, you know. But But, you know, Sandra Cisneros and all that. But then they took Native American work away. They took Sherman Alexie away from them, you know. And so this book is dedicated to those children specifically. And I, some of this book I had done as a chapbook, which I sold to raise funds for them and so forth. But, you know, it took a little bit of anger watching those children be kicked around yet again to really spur me to throw out what felt extraneous and write a pretty, I don't know if it's a brutal book, but it's got some anger in it.
And so the final poem in the book is a hymn.
Yes.
And it is called Hymn to Vatos, Who Will Never Be in a Poem.
Yes.
So you're not going to hear the whole end of this poem, but you'll get the idea. This is Luis Alberto Urrea reading from the last poem in the Tijuana Book of the Dead, published by Soft Skull Press, a book of poetry.
Hymn to Vatos Who Will Never Be in a Poem. All the Vatos sleeping in the hillsides, all the Vatos say goodnight forever, all the Vatos loving their menudo, all the Vatos faith in la tortilla, all the Vatos fearing the alarm clock, all the Vatos wino, jefe, peewee, all the Vatos, even the cabrones, all the Vatos, down por vida homeboys, all the Vatos, using words like ranfla, all the Vatos, waking up abandoned, all the Vatos, not afraid of daughters, all the Vatos, arms around their sisters, all the Vatos, talking to their women, all the Vatos, granting their forgiveness, all the Vatos, plotting wicked paybacks, all the Vatos, sleeping under mota, all the Vatos, with tequila visions, all the Vatos, they call maricones, all the Vatos, bleeding in the alley, all the Vatos, chased by helicopters, all the Vatos, dissed by pinches white boys, all the Vatos, bent to pick tomatoes, all the Vatos, smoked by Agent Orange, all the Vatos, brave in deadly classrooms, all the Vatos, pacing in the prisons, all the Vatos, pierced by needle lightning, all the Vatos, who were once our fathers, all the Vatos, even veteranos, all the Vatos and their abuelitos, all the Vatos proud of tatuajes, all the Vatos carrying a lunch pail, all the Vatos graduating law school, all the Vatos grown up to be curas, all the Vatos never been to misa, all the Vatos Jimmy, Spider, Tito, all the Vatos left their tongues in Spanish.
I've been talking with Luis Alberto Urrea, author of The Water Museum, which is a book of short stories published by Little Brown and Company, and of The Tijuana Book of the Dead, published by Soft Skull Press, a book of poetry. You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Kazuo Ishiguro is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week,
On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.